Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Biden agenda battle. Progressives are forced to sacrifice some of their top priorities as Democrats scramble to reach a deal on the president's spending bill. Then, bomb cyclone. A turbulent weather system threatens millions of Americans as the storm makes its way across the country, spawning floods, tornadoes, and hurricane-force winds. And rethinking college, how jobs requiring a four-year degree are fueling income inequality while disproportionately affecting people of color and rural Americans of all races.
When you put a bachelor's degree screen on a job, you exclude almost 70% of African Americans, almost 80% of Latino workers, and almost 70% of rural workers of all races.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Congressional Democrats spent this Tuesday in a rush trying to work out the contours of a major proposal backed by President Biden that would steer federal dollars toward climate initiatives, expand the U.S. social safety net, and change some aspects of the American tax system. But whether progressives and moderates fall in line behind a single proposal remains up in the air tonight. Lisa Desjardins begins our coverage.
On Capitol Hill, House Democratic leadership insists a historic deal remains within reach, despite distance between the party's moderates and progressives.
We have people who have different perspectives. All of those perspectives are being heard and respected. And at the end of the day, I think we will land in a manner that brings everyone along.
But as negotiations wear on, a number of key issues still remain open. Those include 4 weeks of paid family leave, Medicare expansion, an expansion of Medicaid in states without it, and taxes, including energy taxes. On the House floor, members of the Progressive Caucus made their pitches for a more sweeping piece of legislation.
We cannot tell those families who finally receive the child tax credit that the clock has struck midnight and they can no longer receive it.
Altogether, the Build Back Better agenda will make sure that millions of people in this country and in my home state of Texas gain affordable health care coverage.
On the Senate side, Democratic leadership remained upbeat about reaching a deal soon. Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Democrats will keep working until we're able to reach an agreement and pass this transformational legislation.
Senate Democrats need all 50 votes in their caucus because Republicans remain in lockstep opposition to the reconciliation plan. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell.
This is a 50-50 Senate, a three-seat majority in the House. The American people are not asking for any of this.
At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki was optimistic despite Democrats' slim margins.
I think what we're talking about here is the realities of governing, negotiating, having 50 members of the Senate, not 60 members of the Senate who are Democrats, and the fact that we are still on track to get a historic package through Congress without precedent in history.
One of the most difficult of those 50 Senate Democratic votes to secure has been Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He torpedoed some of the proposals in the earlier $3.5 trillion plan, calling for a much narrower package. Today, Manchin acknowledged he felt pressure as the Democrats swing vote.
This position, I guess, I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
But when asked about both the reconciliation and infrastructure bills passing in the next few months, he was hopeful.
I sure do think there's a high probability that's going to happen.
What exactly happens and how long it takes are still unknown.
And Lisa is here with me now to report on where things stand. So here we go again, Lisa.
Yep.
So it was just a week ago that Democrats said they thought they'd have a framework within days. They have made progress. But you're also talking about it getting more complicated. How so?
That's right. I think the number of marbles on the board increased today. We thought there were just a few open issues. Now there are many. I'm just going to read through this list of things I heard about today. Everything from the methane tax, family leave, Medicare vouchers could be in play for the dental component of that, Medicaid, prescription drugs, housing money, universal pre-K, SALT, those state and local taxes. All of those are things that are now in open discussion over kind of how big or small they go. So I think Democrats have opened up more areas. Still, I do think they're making closer progress. I think that they will come up with a deal, but it's gotten a little more difficult. One thing they did come out with tonight, though, Judy, they have made a decision on taxes, corporate taxes, the official proposal now. Democrats say they have agreed, and we know Kyrsten Sinema is on board, on a 15% minimum corporate tax. That's just one piece of a larger tax proposal that sort of shows you how much is ahead. And there's still questions about whether or not that infrastructure bill will be attached to this or not. Speaker Pelosi and the progressive Pramila Jayapal seem to have different opinions about that issue tonight.
Very interesting and could be significant. Yes. So the Democrats had talked about either a framework or a vote on Build Back Better this week. What does it look like?
This has been a strange time. Some of these timing estimates have almost seemed like fantasy land to many of us who've been covering Congress a long time and our viewers who have been watching. I just do not see how a vote is possible in the Senate this week. A framework, perhaps, but they still have a long way to go. And to give a picture of how unusual these negotiations are, Judy, usually there's one or two meetings of key figures. Today, meetings were happening everywhere, ad hoc. For example, I saw Kyrsten Sinema sitting in the president's chair of the Senate, running the Senate. And in order to speak to her, Senator Elizabeth Warren came up there with Senator Ron Wyden, two key figures on tax policy, to talk to her in the chair of the Senate. Senator Manchin, Senator Sanders found him in the Senate subway and talked to him going down the escalator. So things are happening in a very impromptu, unpredictable way. The energy is high to get there. But at the same time, people are getting tired, and they have to keep that momentum going if they want something in the next few days.
Whatever happened to behind closed doors and smoke-filled rooms?
Well, it's still out of earshot. I need them closer to my earshot, so it's just as bad for me.
Lisa Desjardins, following it all. Thank you.
You're welcome.
In the day's other news, FDA advisors recommended that the agency approve Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds. They said the benefits outweigh a rare side effect of heart inflammation, mostly in boys. And Deborah Birx, who was former President Trump's COVID coordinator, now says that he was distracted by the election and that pandemic response efforts suffered as a result. She has told a congressional panel that this led to more than 130,000 avoidable deaths. The Pentagon is warning that the Islamic State in Afghanistan could be able to strike at the U.S. within 6 to 12 months. Undersecretary of Defense Colin Call gave that assessment at a U.S. Senate hearing today. He said it is not clear if Afghanistan's Taliban rulers can take on ISIS. In Sudan today, the new military ruler defended Monday's coup, claiming his actions helped prevent a civil war. General Abdel Fattah Burhan said that officials in the deposed government could face trial for fomenting discontent and trying to incite rebellion in the army.
This issue reached a deadlock, and the armed forces had a clear choice. So we took the decision to return back to the popular revolution, its luster and laurel, and the possibility of achieving their hopes. We want to continue achieving the demands of the people and achieving the state of freedom, peace, and justice.
Later, the Associated Press reported that the ousted prime minister has been allowed to go home under heavy security. Meanwhile, protesters returned to the streets of Khartoum today to demonstrate against the takeover. Several people were killed yesterday in clashes with security forces. State media in Iran say that a cyber attack closed gas stations across the country today. Fuel pumps were turned off as frustrated drivers waited in long lines for stations to reopen. The disruption affected those trying to use smart cards to buy cheaper, subsidized fuel. There was no word on who might have carried out the hack. The head of the United Nations sounded an urgent call today for world leaders to act on global warming. Secretary General Antonio Guterres spoke days before leaders gather for a climate summit in Scotland. He said they must be bold if they really are serious about curbing greenhouse gas emissions.
The clock is ticking. The emissions gap is the result of a leadership gap. But leaders can still make this a turning point to a greener future instead of a tipping point to climate catastrophe.
The UN's Environment Program reports existing commitments from the world's biggest emitters still fall short of what is needed. Much of the nation is dealing tonight with powerful storms that have brought extreme winds and rain and triggered floods and mudslides. John Yang has our report.
An early nor'easter brought heavy rains and intense winds to the Northeast today. The governors of New York and New Jersey declaring emergencies.
Look at this strong tornado.
In the Midwest, residents in Missouri and Illinois were only beginning to assess damage from a string of tornadoes that touched down Sunday. All as the West Coast also tries to recover from two storms that converged this past weekend, bringing record-setting rains to an area suffering a historic drought. One was a bomb cyclone, a storm that intensifies quickly as the atmospheric pressure drops. The other was an atmospheric river, a long plume of moisture pulled in from the Pacific Ocean. With them came high winds, sounding an eerie whistle from San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge. Heavy rains, which downed trees and knocked out power to 380,000 customers.
It hit our master bedroom in the corner and dropped over the house on our cars.
And flash flooding that blocked cars on highways and streets and led to rock and mudslides.
We've lived here 20 years, never seen it this high.
My whole garage is up to my kneecaps. Everything is floating around.
Electricity to most of those California customers has now been restored, and in the short term, the rains may have helped douse some of the state's wildfires. But it's unclear how much they'll help with the long-term drought. Scientists say more frequent and severe weather like this is a symptom of a warming planet and likely to continue. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
President Biden has rejected a second attempt by former President Trump to invoke executive privilege in a probe of the U.S. Capitol assault. A select committee of the U.S. House of Representatives sought documents on the January 6th attack. The president already blocked Mr. Trump's initial attempt to invoke executive privilege. And on Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 35,756, another record. The NASDAQ rose 9 points. The S&P 500 added 8, also closing at a new high. Still to come on the NewsHour, what's at stake for families as Democrats weigh dropping family leave from the president's spending bill? Congress takes social media giants to task over how their platforms impact the mental health and privacy of children and teens. One Afghan woman's emotional journey from escaping the Taliban to resettling in rural America, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As we've reported, Democrats are trying to whittle down the price tag of their social spending bill. And among the ideas that could be cut is a national paid family leave program. President Biden originally proposed 12 weeks. As we've reported, Democrats have tentatively agreed to cut that to 4 weeks, and even further cuts are still under consideration. As this hangs in the balance, we checked in with people across the country about how this issue has impacted their lives.
Hi, I'm Raina Boston. I am from Tampa, Florida, and I work in human resources for a professional services firm.
My name is Chris Garcia. I live in Denver, Colorado, and I am a mechanical assembler, and I am also a ramp agent for a major airline.
My name is Naya Marshall. I am a restaurateur from the great city of Detroit, Michigan.
My name is Christina Hayes. I'm from Inkster, Michigan. At my previous job, I was working in a call center for a cable company, and I did not have access to paid leave at that time. So I had to work and struggle because I'm a lupus warrior.
Between both jobs, I maybe have 3 weeks total, but not necessarily concurrently.
I am 2 weeks postpartum, so I have a two-week-old, and I am on my second week of paid leave. We have, I believe, a total of 14 weeks paid total. We can go up to 6 months unpaid after that point. And it's been a huge difference between my previous postpartum experiences. I have two other children.
I am a small business. I own a restaurant in the city of Detroit called Ivy Kitchen and Cocktails. We do not offer paid leave currently. We simply can't afford it. Restaurant margins are already small. And since the pandemic, they've even gotten more narrow, if you will.
And so in 2009, I actually had to take my dad off of life support while I was at work. So at the time, I worked as an assistant manager for an auto parts company. And I had been requesting some time off for several months to try and go down and be with my father. Unfortunately, I kept getting denied.
Treatment for lupus includes like regular doctor visits, chemo treatments, steroid treatments. So due to not having paid leave, I was not going to my doctor appointments and getting my checkups that I needed. And it came down to the point where my health made the decision for me, and then I ended up passing out at work and had to be taken out on a stretcher.
I didn't even get to see them, you know, really bury my father because I left to come back to work. So all in all, I ended up out of work for almost a week, about a week and a half. And financially, it took me almost 6.5 months to recover.
So going into this leave, knowing that I had 14 weeks paid, not only did it reduce the stress, but I also felt valued as a person who just happens to be the part of a partnership that gives birth, that my time and my contributions are valuable.
Most small business owners, we're not rich, we're not wealthy. You know what I mean? Most of us do what we do because we love it. And I know my restaurant is a labor of love for my community. You know what I mean? I'm not getting rich off of it at all. And so if I were forced to do something like that, then I would really strongly have to evaluate the total cost of implementing that program. And it might even actually close my doors. I'm not sure.
Those personal stories are a good illustration of what this debate over paid family leave is all about. Let's widen out now to look at the larger situation in the U.S. Jody Hyman studies this as part of her work at the World Policy Analysis Center at UCLA. Jody Hyman, welcome to the NewsHour. First of all, give us a sense of how much of the developed world already does offer some sort of paid leave for employees.
Nearly the entire world, not just high-income countries, but low- and middle-income countries offer paid leave. So 181 countries out of 192 offer paid sick leave. Even more, 185 offer paid maternity leave. About half as many paid leave for dads. It's overwhelmingly what countries do.
There's still a lot we don't know about what Congress is discussing, and certainly not what they're going to end up with. But the reporting is that what was in the original proposal, 12 weeks of paid family leave, they're looking at cutting that possibly to 4 weeks. How much difference would that make?
Going down to 4 weeks would be a huge loss. I think we just have to think about the circumstances. First, someone getting sick. If someone has cancer, they're not going to be treated and well 4 weeks later. If someone has a heart attack, being able to return to physical labor that fast, not likely. And importantly, we know we can afford it. Again, over 130 countries actually offer 12 weeks or more. So how can they afford it? Because it saves money to do it, among other things. It makes people healthier. But we wouldn't have had the kind of shutdowns with COVID if we'd had better paid sick leave.
And again, we don't know how much government subsidy could end up being involved. But as we heard from small business owners like Naya Marshall, one of the Americans we heard from a minute ago, they are concerned that if they have to do this, it could cost them so much they might not be able to keep their business open.
I think it's incredibly important to speak to small businesses on this. And here's what I'd like to say to our colleagues who own or run small businesses. Again, nearly all the world covers small business without exception for size. Why? Because government helps. So the restaurateur we heard from, she shouldn't have to pay the paid leave. That's what the social insurance system is for, and that's how most of the world does it. They do it in ways that government support for the insurance system means it's not coming out of the pockets of small business. Importantly, small business can save money because their workers will be healthier. because there'll be less spread of infectious disease, there'll be less chronic illness, their health care costs can come down.
And Jody Hyman, one of the arguments we've heard from some Republican members of Congress is they might be willing to go along with parental leave, a parent leaving to take care of a child, but not so much for family leave or for caregiving for another family member. What about that, making that distinction?
I think it's important we talk about all three elements. The parental leave, which you've already mentioned, the paid sick leave, I want to highlight again, we just came out this pandemic, you know, trillions of dollars because of the spread. We are one of the few countries, all the countries that didn't have national sick leave, they did worse in the pandemic. So there's a lot of savings in pandemic years, but also in regular years with influenza, diarrheal disease, lower rates of chronic conditions. What about the third kind of leave, leave for a family member who's sick? I think one thing we can think about is, can that leave be shared across multiple family members? So for each family member, it's shorter, but the total amount of leave is there.
And no question, we are looking at many, in many cases, at individuals at the lower end of the income scale, the ones who most need this kind of support. Jody Hyman, who's with the World Policy Analysis Center at UCLA, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Judy.
A Senate committee is widening its investigation into the impact social media platforms have on children, teens, and young adults, with more apps facing congressional scrutiny. William Brangham has our coverage, beginning with this report and a warning. This story contains sensitive subject matter, including discussion of suicide.
I don't think parents are going to stand by while our kids and our democracy become collateral damage to a profit game.
On Capitol Hill, executives from YouTube, Snapchat, and TikTok were grilled by lawmakers on what these wildly popular platforms are doing to protect children online and exactly what kinds of material kids are able to access.
Kids as young as 9 have died doing viral challenges on TikTok.
Today marks the first time representatives from TikTok and Snapchat have appeared before Congress. Among the many issues lawmakers asked about, how to prevent dealers selling counterfeit pills and illegal substances to young people.
If a kid had just walked into, say, a pharmacy, you wouldn't be able to buy that or get that.
Senator, it's not just happening on our platform, it's happening on others. So therefore, we need to work collectively.
I think there's other ways to do this, too, as creating liability when this happens. So maybe that'll make you work even faster so we don't lose another kid.
For much of the hearing, lawmakers pushed the executives to further limit certain features available to kids, such as autoplay of videos, targeted ad content, and the like and dislike buttons, which can keep children online longer and potentially expose them to bullying. Executives stressed they have systems in place to flag harmful content and illegal activity, and that efforts to combat misinformation have been expanded. The executives also pledged to share more data and research on how their platforms impact teens and young adults, but they often fell short of pledging full support for a number of bills that have already been introduced. And lawmakers continued their calls for more transparency.
What's your response to the Wall Street Journal article that described in detail how TikTok's algorithm serves up sex and drug videos to minors?
We disagree with that being an authentic experience that an actual user would have.
Another point of contention was how these platforms can ensure that children only see content that's appropriate for their age.
The content that appears on Snapchat is appropriate for an age group of 13 and above.
I beg to differ. I had my staff create a Snapchat account for a 13-year-old, for a 15-year-old child. They were immediately bombarded with content that I can most politely describe as wildly inappropriate for a child, including recommendations for, among other things, an invite to play an online sexualized video game and articles about porn stars.
any online sexual video game should be age-gated to 18 and above, so I am unclear why that content would have shown up.
Lawmakers sought clarity on how these companies police content that poses serious risks to users.
We heavily invest in making sure that all of our users, but particularly kids on the platform, have a safe experience.
I'm quoting from searches that we've done. Songs to slit your wrist by, vertical slit wrist. Do the self-harm and suicide videos violate YouTube's content guideline?
Senator, I would certainly welcome following up with you on that video. Yes. You may be referencing.
Legislators also wanted to know what data was being collected about children by these platforms.
TikTok actually collects less in many categories than many of our peers.
Which of your competitors or other companies that you're aware of collect more information?
Facebook and Instagram, for example.
Being different from Facebook is not a defense. That bar is in the gutter.
While the companies tried to separate themselves from each other, lawmakers from both sides agreed more action is needed to ensure kids are safe online. For more on how these platforms are affecting kids' mental health, we turn to Jean Twenge. She's a professor of psychology at San Diego State University and the author of iGen, Why Today's Superconnected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and completely unprepared for adulthood. Jean Twenge, great to have you back on the NewsHour. So as we heard today, a lot of concern on Capitol Hill expressed about the potential for these platforms to be causing harm to young people. What do we know about the actual research as to whether or not these things do cause harm?
Yeah, so generally speaking, the more time a kid or a teen spends in front of a screen, the more likely they are to be depressed, anxious, to harm themselves. And there's gradations to this. Watching videos isn't as strongly linked to depression as, say, being on social media. But especially when kids and teens spend a lot of time online, it leaves less time for sleep. It leaves less time for interacting with people face-to-face, leaves less time for running around outside and exercising. And so perhaps as a result, what we've seen is a huge increase in teen depression right at the time that these platforms became very popular.
So do you feel that is this causal or is this a correlation? I mean, do you feel confident that it's these platforms themselves or simply, as you're describing, the sort of opportunity cost that if you've got a screen in front of your face, you're not doing all these other things that we know are healthier for kids?
Yeah, so, you know, this is complex. There's many, many issues at stake here. So one is that time spent, that especially when it gets excessive to 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, then it crowds out time for things that are more beneficial. Then there's the question of content, which was discussed a lot today, that there's a lot of negative content that kids get exposed to on these platforms. And as to whether it's causal, that's been a really hard question to answer. There have been some studies that have, say, had college students cut back on their social media use. And they found after 3 weeks, the ones who cut back on their social media use were more mentally healthy than those who continued their usual high level of use. So that really points in the direction of at least some of that causation is going from using these platforms, especially many hours a day, toward depression and other mental health issues.
So how does this body of research translate? If I'm a parent debating what to do with my child and devices and social media, what is the current state of best advice for parents?
Well, parents are in a tough position. I mean, this is one reason why we need more policy and regulation in this area, because you have the fear that if your kid doesn't use social media, then they'll be left out. And if they do use social media, then there's these mental health issues, negative content, and so on. So I think there's two important things. First, just put off having your kid get social media for as long as you can. 10 is too young. It's actually the law. You need to be 13. But even 13 is pretty young to start with social media. So try to put it off to 15 or 16 or even later. And then the second aspect is just to make sure that they're using social media and video platforms in moderation, that it's not taking over their life, crowding out time that could be spent on other things. If they want to spend an hour or two a day outside of school on these platforms, not a big deal. It's not really linked to depression. It's when that use gets to 4, 5, 6 hours and beyond that it's much more concerning for mental health and other issues.
Really is a remarkable social experiment we're conducting right now. Jean Twenge of San Diego State University, always good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thousands of Afghan refugees are now in the United States following their evacuation as the Taliban took over Afghanistan. Those refugees are mostly scattered among 8 military bases around the United States. But some 10,000 have been released and resettled into different communities. Nick Schifrin has one of their stories.
On the morning of August 15th, when the Afghan government still led the country, Mukadesha Yorish was where she always was on Sunday, a work day, in her office as a commissioner of Afghanistan's civil service.
I was in office when my mom called me and she wanted me to be home. And I told her, listen, I have to be in office because I have to wrap up a couple of things, so I might be home around 6. And then she told me that it's over.
For 20 years, Yorish had worked to create a modern, inclusive Afghanistan. She'd been a public servant, a former deputy minister of commerce, an NGO leader, a voice of her generation. But that day, it all unraveled. The Taliban seized the presidential palace, the city, and the country. Yorish and her family moved from house to house to avoid Taliban fighters now on patrol.
Did you feel like your life was in danger if certain members of the Taliban found you?
Once they took over, reports started coming in of them trying to identify former government officials. We left our entire house because we didn't have the time to pack it and wish that I would have just taken a final look at our house and at my room, my books. I just didn't have the chance, you know. I only had a couple of minutes to pack my entire life in a suitcase.
Like so many, she rushed for the airport. She was one of the lucky ones. She got through the chaos and onto a flight destined to the U.S.
I think that's when it hit me that you know, I was leaving and I was flying out and leaving my soul back in the country. So everybody that I knew who was boarding that plane with us were crying. Every single person. It's the first time I'm talking about this, and it's not easy. It's not easy to try to leave home, everything. And nobody does it, unless and until they fear for the safety of themselves and their family.
6,800 miles away, in rural Wisconsin, lies Sparta, a town of 10,000, where American flags fly on Main Street and nearby Fort McCoy has stood sentry for more than a century. It became Yorish's temporary home, a Spartan sanctuary, disconnected from the life she had to leave behind. Recently, Fort McCoy invited a pool camera to film Afghan refugees' life on base. There are more than 12,000 refugees here, half children.
I would like 2 books, please.
They take classes.
7 days, breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Eat food, now certified halal. And live in barracks, usually reserved for service members.
The spaces are certainly shared. You don't get to have your private room, you know, so you have to put up with the fact that you will be sharing your space with other families, and we certainly feel grateful for the generosity and the warmness and the hospitality that we have received here. The bigger question for all of us here is what would the future hold for every one of us? And to try to think of just equipping yourself with the right tools to start a new life over when you already had one.
That old way of life is being attacked. Some Taliban fighters have beaten women for protesting. The Taliban detain Afghans they accuse of being criminals and sometimes parade them in the streets. In the central square of the western city of Herat last month, they hanged a man from a crane.
Every day it brings a new atrocity that the Taliban have committed, making sure that women disappear from the public spaces. And then to look back and know that you were actively part of creating that progress.
And now a second catastrophe, economic meltdown. Banks don't have cash. Families are selling furniture so they can buy food. The Taliban can't pay people's salaries. And the U.S. and its allies are refusing to release billions of dollars in reserves.
I would like to, call on the world to tell them that the people of Afghanistan don't deserve being punished like this, and that if anything, in the past 20 years, the people of Afghanistan have shown the resilience that the world might not have known.
Resilience from two decades of progress. In 16-year-old Mara Matayi's piano virtuosity. Millions of Afghan girls who embraced education as soon as the Taliban were overthrown in 2001. And independent TV channels watched by millions. This weekend, after our interview, Yorish and her family resettled in Washington, D.C.
We feel very lucky to have Mukadessa Yorish.
And she received an award from former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton for being a change maker.
Join me in my desperate hope for the country, because to be able to do anything, you first need to believe in something. And I still believe in my country.
Yorish insists that she and other Afghans who had to flee are no victims. And on that final day in Kabul, she realized she needed to either get busy living or get busy dying.
Dying is not always physical. If I would have been back home right now, I just would have been a silent observer. To me, that is gradual death in itself. When the Taliban took over, I think I had two choices, to stay and die or try to leave, keep my voice, be here on this show and try to continue, to do my work and advocate for an Afghanistan that I think the people of Afghanistan deserve to live in. And I decided and I chose to stay alive and I chose my voice. One clarity that I have is that anything that I would do will be in the hope that that will take me back home.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
It has long been a given that a four-year college degree is a prerequisite for moving up the economic ladder. But for some, that requirement is having unintended consequences. Paul Solman has the story for our series on Rethinking College.
So I type in, yep. C-O-N-S-T, space, port.
In Durham, North Carolina, software engineer Tony Bird is so sure of his skills, he was game to try to teach me how to code.
Space 3000.
Semicolon.
And the spaces and the format is very particular.
I love understanding systems. And that's
white hat hacker Oscar Anaya, who grew up dirt poor in a Texas border town, is pretty confident himself.
Because I've always been good at computer hacking.
In Cumberland, Maryland, the heart of Appalachian coal country,
my high school mascot was a coal miner.
Cybersecurity engineer John Hartman isn't bashful either.
There was no better candidate than me for that job.
But Hartman didn't have a college degree. Neither did Anaya or Bird. And that alone kept them out of good jobs for years. Bird, quarterback of his high school football team, let his chance for an athletic scholarship simply slip away.
I just kept procrastinating and pushing it off and didn't put in the, you know, application form like I should have.
Instead, he wound up working as a barista for 7 years. His current colleague, Mariana Perez, also now a software engineer, toiled as a manicurist for 9 years as she struggled to pay for community college.
I had to stop work, make sure I had the money, and then continue because I didn't want to have loans.
In John Hartman's second year of community college,
my car just broke down. I had an 88 Ford Bronco. The transmission went out on me twice. I can't afford to go to college. I need to go get a job.
At a local factory, building cabinets, followed by a stint as a freight train conductor, then shift work at a paper mill.
One of the most dangerous industries that there is, chemicals, moving machinery that anybody could get swept into and hurt.
Oscar Anaya also dropped out of community college and took high-risk work on an oil rig.
In the sun with chemicals and helicopters and things like that, I was breathing in a lot of small, fine particles of granite. So it completely destroyed my nostrils and my sinuses. So I had to leave that job. I was like, you know what? I'm good with computers. I should try doing something with computers. So I applied and I applied and I applied. No one was picking me up.
Why was no one picking you up?
Something's happening that is just not letting me through. And the only criteria that I could think of is education. And I honestly started falling into a very nihilistic way of seeing the world, and where I was like, you know what, this is just how it's going to be. I'm probably never going to make as much as my friends are making because I just didn't finish college.
You mean you had good reason to believe you were being rejected because you didn't have a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
That then made you feel inadequate because you didn't have a college degree?
It contributed to my downward spiral emotionally, yes.
Anaya is far from alone, says economist Byron Auguste.
Over the last 40 years, we've come to a place where the vast majority of middle-class jobs require a bachelor's degree to be considered.
Sometimes to the point of absurdity.
Even though two-thirds of administrative assistants don't have bachelor's degrees, three-quarters of the new job postings for administrative assistants say you have to have a bachelor's degree to be considered for that job. So two-thirds of the people who currently do that job can't apply for three-quarters of the new jobs in the field.
But why?
Sometimes a company will require a college degree just because they can.
Hiring expert Nick Korkadilos, who runs the Ask the Headhunter website, says the degree hurdle emerged as help wanted ads moved online and the number of applicants per job exploded.
Sometimes a company will get 10,000 applicants for one job. How do they winnow them out? One of the easiest ways is just to require a college degree.
Well, this is obviously discriminatory against people who don't have a college degree, right?
Well, but you can't accuse a company of discriminating because they asked for a college degree, can you? You can't process people through a database. You can process their keywords through a database. And a college degree is nothing more than a keyword.
But the net effect is discriminatory. Overall, more than 60% of American workers don't have a four-year degree. But, says Byron Auguste,
when you put a bachelor's degree screen on a job, you exclude almost 70% of African Americans. You exclude almost 80% of Latino workers. And by the way, you exclude almost 70% of rural workers of all races.
And that, says Auguste, has been fueling inequality since 1980. Pushing wages for those with just a high school diploma down 13%, adjusted for inflation, while wages for those with a four-year degree have risen by 13%. For men, the difference in lifetime earnings is now around $1 million.
To say that college can be a bridge to opportunity, well, that's great. But to make college a drawbridge that pulls up, and if you can't cross it, then you have no path to opportunity.
And you wind up in the low-wage moat.
So I did a little bit of valet parking.
I finally got on with UPS as a package handler for the Christmas season.
I went into retail. I sold computers.
I'm tired of being at the mercy of all these other jobs. I want a career.
This simplistic bachelor's degree screen, it's really outlived its usefulness. So employers are leaving so much talent on the table.
Not all employers, however. IBM, for instance, has Earn While You Learn apprenticeship programs, which have trained the four people you've now met. No experience required, though Oscar Anaya, now on IBM's top hacker team, already had plenty of skills.
I've been hacking computers since I was 12 years old.
Because that was the only way he could get a computer.
We were extremely poor, so what could I afford?
An old one for $20, locked. So he had to hack his way in. And fittingly, during his apprenticeship interview,
he was asking me about how to break into things.
Like electronic ankle bracelets.
I told him that a lot of the attacks could be done with a $3 screwdriver and a couple of cables, which is something that your, you know, security tester would not imagine. And yeah, that's how I got accepted into the IBM apprenticeship.
As did Tony Bird, after his 7 years behind the Starbucks counter in the IBM lobby.
When did it occur to you that you could actually work at IBM?
So that's when my friend Dave comes in.
Software engineer Dave Green, who was a regular customer.
It happened one day when he asked me, how do I go upstairs and do what you're doing? I'm like, well, you just gotta learn how to talk to computers. And he asked me, can you teach me how to do that? And I said, what are you doing during lunch?
Green tutored, Bird learned the basics of coding. On his second try, he passed the apprenticeship test and immediately tripled his pay.
Are you sorry you didn't go to college?
Nope, not now.
And so a final question for philosopher and longtime professor Martha Nussbaum.
Do you think every young person in America should go to college?
Yes. Well, everyone who wants to. Going to college has three purposes. One is to prepare you for a job. A second is to prepare you for a life full of richness and meaning. And a third is to prepare you to be a good citizen.
As she argues in her book, Not for Profit, without good citizens, democracy dies. But she adds,
the first thing is everyone should have the opportunity to do it without crushing burden of cost.
That's why IBM's former software apprentices could hardly believe their ears when IBM's Kelly Jordan told them.
We've been partnering with the American Council on Education, and they've actually determined that the Software Development Apprenticeship Program is worth up to 45 college credits, which is the equivalent of 3 semesters of college.
Wow.
Based on the completion
that's,
of the IBM apprenticeship.
Huge.
Putting Tony Bird close to an associate's degree.
Wow, that's great. That's impressive. That's good news.
That's a great news. Thank you.
And Mariana Perez, close to her bachelor's, though she no longer needs one to get a high-paying job. For the PBS NewsHour, Paul Solman.
As California faces what is predicted to be one of its worst droughts in recorded history, water managers are seeing record increases in water theft, leaving communities angry and police playing a continuous game of whack-a-mole with water bandits on the move. Brihanda Lyons of the nonprofit news site Cal Matters has the story of how water meant for residential use is flowing to illegal marijuana farms.
In California's desert, a San Bernardino County water manager who didn't want to be identified doubles as an amateur detective.
These are all cannabis farms. Here's a great big one. This is one of the guys that I kicked off the water station. He was taking a lot of loads of water.
Bandits are stealing millions of gallons of water. Driving water trucks, tankers, and pickups, they're tapping into lakes and rivers, fire hydrants, and filling stations. They're siphoning off water from homes, farms, and wells. So who's on the receiving end of all this stolen water? Local officials say it's often illegal pot farms, which is an estimated $8 billion industry in California.
There's one over there. There's some out there.
The desert is now strewn with makeshift pot farms. California allows them with proper permits and local approval, but the penalty for growing even thousands of marijuana plants is only a misdemeanor and a $500 fine. 80% of California's roughly 30,000 pot farms are illegal, according to the State Water Board.
Where these grows are, they do not have running water hooked up there. So they either have to drill wells or they have to truck in water from other areas. And that's where the incentive to steal water comes from.
From Siskiyou County on the Oregon border to San Bernardino County on its Arizona border, some California communities are seeing their municipal water being stolen. In Hellendale, the local water district hired a private security guard to investigate who was stealing water. Kelly Gregg's discovery was alarming.
So what we found was a multitude of locations the illegal grows were pulling water from. Some of those locations are on abandoned properties, private properties, and the like.
In addition to outright theft, there's also a black market where residents sell their water to middlemen. In Hellendale, a court ruling restricts how much water residents can pump for their own use. But when black market buyers show up with their tanks and their cash, landowners cut deals, says Kimberly Cox, manager of Hellendale's water supply.
Wells, in many cases, are now abandoned, or the people that are living in those houses with the wells will sell their water to these haulers.
The state can fine bandits up to $1,000 a day, but that's a pittance for players in a multi-billion dollar illegal pot industry. Tim Smith, president of Hellendale's Water Services, is frustrated.
There's no teeth in any of the laws. We're at the mercy of whatever.
Local police have started raiding more illegal pot farms to try to reduce demand. But for people like Johansson, who's been a victim of water theft, the influx of new water users has complicated the mundane task of hauling water to her home.
I don't know who breaks my water lines and does all this chaotic crap they do, but I mean, they steal constantly up here.
The San Bernardino water manager says she's frustrated by the lack of authority to deal with water theft.
Is there a mechanism to cut off the water of these farms without having a response be very negative and forceful? No one's tried this. We're not enforcement officers. We don't carry guns.
In the meantime, Governor Gavin Newsom has asked Californians to cut their water uses by 15%. The State Water Board recently moved to temporarily stop thousands of Central Valley farmers from diverting water from a major watershed.
There is a reluctance to ask our customers to cut back when there is this kind of customer. It seems to be taking the water without regard for the drought.
As climate change continues to wreak havoc, causing fires and droughts, California's demand for water shows no signs of easing, whether for use in homes, fields, or illegal pot farms. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Baronda Lyons in Richmond, California.
And yes, all this as the world worries about climate change and heads into a global conference, in fact, to talk about it. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening for all of us at the PBS NewsHour. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.